to search for survivors. Thousands of people in Jakarta and nearby Bandung have been forced from their homes over the last 2 weeks by flooding triggered by monsoon rains. Deadly landslides and floods are a yearly occurrence in Indonesia. Rampant deforestation and poor management of stormwater have been blamed for worsening the effect of seasonal rainfall. For NPR News, I'm Chad Bouchard in Jakarta.
Voters in the Netherlands will choose a new government in early June. The current government resigned after the coalition cabinet could not resolve a dispute over the Netherlands' role in NATO's effort in Afghanistan. The Dutch government refused NATO's request to keep troops in southern Afghanistan. A dozen liberal members of the Dutch government then quit. The current Dutch prime minister has been asked to stay on. He'll serve as a caretaker until elections. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Warner Home Video, presenting The Informant, the new comedy starring Matt Damon and directed by Steven Soderbergh. Available on Blu-ray and DVD today.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly, host of Live and Local on FM 90.9. Join me each weekday at noon for an hour of conversation with local musicians and other performers, as well as guest artists visiting our listening area. We feature frequent live performances in our studio and a daily calendar of events you can see and hear live. It's Live and Local, your connection to local music and more, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be spending some time talking about a little bit about the politics of South Africa and also about feminism in South Africa and maybe in Africa as well in a larger kind of a sense. And our guest for the program this morning in this hour is Elaine Salo. She is director of the Institute for Women's and Gender Studies at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. She is visiting the campus here of the University of Illinois to give a talk. This is the annual W.E.B. Du Bois lecture on the topic Lessons in Leadership for Africa, Listening to Learning from Feminist Pan-African Discussions, Activism, and Scholarship. This is an event that is open to anyone who would like to attend, taking place on the campus this afternoon. She'll be giving her talk at the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor, 4 o'clock this afternoon, and certainly anyone who's interested should feel welcome to stop by. Before her, the job that she has now, Dr. Salo was a senior lecturer at the African Gender Institute at University of Cape Town, and in her current role, she's interested in promoting gender justice and women's human rights. She's with us here in the studio this morning, and we're pleased to have her here. Questions are welcome. People want to join this conversation. That's easy to do. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so that one's good to anywhere that you're listening. If it would be a long-distance call, use that. That's 800-222-9455. And the email, if you'd like to contribute that way, you can do that by writing to Will, that's W-I-L-O, will-talk at illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, and good morning to your listeners.
I thought I'd like to start with this point, and it's something that I came across in some writing that you did some years ago that I thought was a very interesting idea. And that was at the point when the old South African government lifted the ban on the political participation by anti-apartheid organizations like the African National Congress or the Pan-Africanist Congress. That these groups now could organize, could become politically active in ways that they couldn't before because they were officially considered to be illegal. Something apparently also happened at the time that hadn't really been expected, and that is that also created an opening for women's organizations to become much more active and to make gender a national issue in a way that it had not been before. And I thought this was very interesting, and it would maybe give us an opportunity to talk a little bit about the connections between the national liberation struggle and the women's liberation struggle in South Africa. Maybe you could go back to that time and talk a little bit about what happened.
Well, at the time that the organizations were still banned, a lot of us who were part of what was then called the United Democratic Front in the women's movement, we experienced conflict all the time because in one sense we were expected to support the national liberation movement. And on the other side of that, there were all of these aspects of gender inequality, both within the organization and in broader society, that we were also concerned about and wanted to debate, but constantly felt that we would be seen as traitors if we debated these issues out in the broader public. And given that the United Democratic Front and what was then, which would later on become the Mass Democratic Movement, was under such severe pressure, there was a lot of pressure not to surface the issues on gender inequality within the organization and to expend energies dealing with this in broader society as well. It's not to say that we didn't deal with it, but there was this tension all the time within our organizations.
Yeah. And how was that stated in a very direct way?
Well, the debates within the organizations were very vociferous. And at the time, I mean, I was part of the women's movement that was linked up with the United Democratic Front, and I was a faculty member at the University of the Western Cape, which was seen as directly aligned with the African Nationalist Congress and the United Democratic Movement. And the debates were there. They were vociferous. They were tense. I remember the debate at UWC at the point when there were issues around sexual harassment and rape on the campus between students and within the faculty. There was a lot of pressure from the administration as well not to surface these issues. Because the media, mainstream media, was seen as to be not portraying the Institute and the Mass Democratic Movement and the UDF in favorable light. Mm-hmm. So when the organizations were banned, unbanned, which, well, it's been 20 years since Mandela's was freed, and about that same time when the ANC and the Pan-Africanist Congress and all the other smaller organizations were unbanned, that allowed us a space to surface all of these issues. And also the moment of CODESA 1 and 2, which were the negotiation talks, opened up opportunity to lobby for a women's charter and for women to participate in the debates at the negotiation tables. The Women's National Coalition was formed for that specific purpose. And this coalition was across all of these racial, religious, and even political divides as well. But it was a momentary alliance. Mm-hmm. That set the scene for us to be able to at least make claims for political representation as women. But on the other side of it, there were also simmering under the surface LGBTI issues. For example, Simon Corley, who was a revered and celebrated anti-apartheid student leader, came out as a gay man to his comrades in prison. And I know that was also an issue of fracture as well. And Archbishop Desmond Tutu had to come in and mediate in that situation. But it also gave opportunity for lesbian, gay people at the time who were also at the forefront in leadership positions in the United Democratic Movement and its allies to come up and say, we demand that LGBTI rights also be taken on board. And a lot of prominent people were behind that. Edward Cameron, who is one of our constitutional judges, Simon Corley, as I said, and he was the founder member of the gay and lesbian organization of Witwatersrand that started the first gay pride march in Johannesburg. And a slew of other prominent names were behind that. And so that gave impetus to making the demand for gender rights in terms of that broad spectrum to come to the surface.
Yeah. So were there, though, people even at that point who said that the struggle hasn't been completed yet, we're just starting out here, there are important issues that we still have to deal with, and people who were saying to women or saying to others, just wait a little bit. Just wait. We'll get to this later.
That was the kernel of this debate. That was at the heart of all of these tensions. And the women's organizations across the country quickly lobbied around a women's charter as well, which was also placed on the agenda. Now, the demands made in the women's charter were taken on very unevenly at the negotiation table and in terms of the constitution. But that movement, together with the Women's National Coalition, as well as the demand for gay and lesbian equality rights, at least saw the inclusion of what's called the Section 9 rights in our constitution, which demands that there'll be no discrimination on the basis of gender, sexual orientation, race, religious persuasion, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Were there other specific issues that women were concerned about?
Yes, they. Subsequent to that, the Reconstruction and Development Program was the program that was formulated under the Mandela government to seek some form of redress in terms of socioeconomic issues in the country. And there was a lobby to gender that program as well. Again, the gender aspect, specifically in terms of women's interests, was taken on unevenly. And when you revisit the document, you can actually see that the people who compiled it didn't quite grasp what it meant to gender a program such as that. But nevertheless, it was there. Unfortunately, when halfway through the Mandela government, the Growth, Economic and Redistribution Program was taken on, which was a conservative economic program, and it cut back expenditure in the social services, education, health and so on, which are feminized sectors. So at the moment that you saw a victory, in a sense, for gendered issues within the Constitution, you also saw a rolling back in terms of of what was called GEAR, the socioeconomic issues. And that is still an issue that is being contested. For the first 6 years of the Mandela government as well, we saw the women's budget being lobbied through in cabinet through the work of Prex Govender and Debbie Budlander. But the Minister of Finance then, after GEAR was taken on board, that quickly got dropped, because I think what it implied was that the state had to take on fairly radical economic reforms in order to realize the aims and goals of such a budget, gender budget. Mm-hmm. So I think what we've seen in the post-apartheid moment have been peaks in terms of gains for gender activists, both in terms of LGBTI rights as well as women's rights, but also defeats. I'm thinking of the Land Act, specifically the Customary Land Act, which put the control of land in rural areas specifically under the control of the chiefs, even though the demography of our rural areas is such that women dominate as the major part of the population there. But then we've also had successes in terms of the Sexual Offences Act, which has redefined who can be the victims of rape. The Domestic Violence Act has also been expanded in terms of raising opportunities for women to seek protection and demand protection from the criminal justice system, the police, and the Child Maintenance Act as well. So it's been an uneven road with both gains and challenges since the onset of the post-apartheid moment.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Elaine Sullo. She's director of the Institute for Women's and Gender Studies at University of Pretoria, South Africa. She's visiting the campus, will be giving the annual W.E.B. Du Bois lecture this afternoon, Lessons in Leadership for Africa. Listening to, Learning from Feminist Pan-African Discussions, Activism and Scholarship, that's the title. 4 o'clock this afternoon in the Levis Center. Anyone interested should stop by. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps the question is better asked in a fairly specific way, but overall, would you say that, so we were talking about it's been 20 years now, that women's lives in South Africa are better now than they were?
I think in terms of legislation, we have our rights enshrined. In terms of the implementation and the realization of those rights, that is also, that is still a battle. Bear in mind that the Gini coefficient in the country has increased so that we happen to have the highest levels of inequality in the world. We've surpassed Brazil. So the rural-urban divide, which onto which one maps this inequity, is a major issue. And what you're seeing is a surfacing of practices and claims associated with culture that I think are abuses of gender rights. But I think the forces that have informed the surfacing of these practices that have died long ago is also due to socioeconomic inequity and desperation in these areas.
Can you give a concrete example of what it is that you're talking about?
Sure. For example, in the Eastern Cape, long ago, there used to be a practice among the Xhosa-speaking people called ukutwala, which was forced marriage through kidnapping of young women. That practice died out, and I think it might have died out in the 50s, 40s, 50s. Currently, we're seeing a resurfacing of that, younger women who are being kidnapped by older men, but with the acquiescence of parents who, I suspect, oftentimes cannot afford to raise these young people, young women specifically. Then there's also the aspect of virginity testing that has surfaced in KZN, KwaZulu-Natal. But that is related to moral panics around HIV/AIDS because the seroprevalence rates are highest in that specific province. And there is the sense that at least if young women's virginity is protected over time through the threat of shaming with virginity testing, that HIV/AIDS rates will come down, or that communities are able to protect themselves. Of course, it doesn't take into account the practices of masculinity that inform that seroprevalence rate. But those are issues that we are currently sitting with. But it is in a context of great inequality and in the context of a pandemic of HIV/AIDS.
Well, you're saying that, or are you suggesting that really the way to address that is for there to be greater opportunities for women so that they have more economic power? They have more say, perhaps, in their communities, more say in their families, and that kind of power can be extended to maybe exercising greater control over their lives in other ways.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the issue. That if we empower women at the level of decision making and through socioeconomic empowerment, that would give women greater control over their reproductive lives and over their lives and that of their dependents, generally speaking. Look, the issue around cultural practices is a thorny one, but we need to open that up for debate in the country. And we saw the surface with the 2 years ago with the rape trial of our current president, Jacob Zuma, where you had mainly urban-based feminist organizations protesting in support of the young woman who was the alleged victim. in the rape. And then on the other side, you had women and men performing a cultural identity in support of the alleged perpetrator, Jacob Zuma. And those were the aspects of the debate that were surfacing very vigorously in the context. And that's still simmering in the country as well. So I think we need to take that on board in a more in a more public fashion, and not be put off by the claims defense of silencing uses of the term culture. We really need more vigorous debate around these issues.
Well, what sort of progress has there been made in creating opportunities for women in education, in employment? And I'm certain that you would say not as much as there needs to be.
Well, the opportunities have been created. There's been a whole suite of legislative tools that have been put into place since the onset of democracy, in the form of equity plans and laws, something called broad-based economic opportunities that, I'm sorry, I suffer from the South African disease of acronyms. So I'm thinking if we call them triple BEE and EE plans, which are employment equity plans and so on and so forth. And education institutions are required by government to indicate what they've done in terms of redressing the past inequities of access. Unfortunately, 20 years is a short time, and I think we've come a long way, but 20 years is too short a time to do the redress of 200 years of systematic discrimination, racist and economic discrimination. And so what one sees is people like myself who've had the privilege of being raised in middle class, I suppose, or lower middle class households, and parents who had the cultural capital to make one aware of the value of education and of skilling and so on, and who didn't have problems educating both daughters and sons. We've been the ones who've able to benefit from these equity, the suite of equity legislation. But there's a whole mass of other young people who are struggling, specifically young women, struggling with the socialization of into a specific expectation of femininity, and yet having to break those expectations in order to acquiesce, to access the opportunities of the educational institutions substantively. So it doesn't help a young woman, for example, to be able to access a degree program when she's expected to come home and fill in terms of a mothering and parenting role, which takes away time that you could have spent more fruitfully engaged in study. And if you couple that with notions of violence and the threat of violence in our public spaces after dark and on public transport, then it gets a little complicated. So it's not just about, setting up the legislation. It's also about making sure that the practices that enable that legislation exists as well. So it means challenging organizational cultures that allow for sexual harassment to be seen as normal, challenging family cultural practices that demand women do certain things and men others. So do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's a multiple challenging a process that needs to be set in place so that the legislation is only one part of it.
Well, that it also gets me thinking about the difficulty of negotiating culture or kinds of ideas, beliefs, and practices that people label as culture,
mm-hmm.
It gets me thinking about how I think in South Africa, maybe other places too, as people talked about gender, there are some people who make this argument that, well, all this concerned about gender and gender roles, that's not part of our culture. It's had something to do with colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that there are people who say, well, why are we even talking? Why are we even talking about this? It just gets people confused. And it just gets people arguing. And we're maybe again, it also goes back to the idea that some people say that it just divides people, particularly it divides men and women. And that all this preoccupation with gender is just a lot of trouble. And it's not for us anyway.
Well, that's a lazy approach, I think. And it's for the faint-hearted to just acquiesce in that as a solution, because what it demands of everyone in society is a critical self-evaluation and a reflection upon practices that we accept as normal throughout all of our institutions. So we have a critical men's forum, for example, an organization called Sonke Gender Justice, which demands of South African men to take another look in terms of the practices of masculinities and the value systems that have been taken for granted in these everyday practices. And the same is said for example, with LGBTI activist organizations, because you know, people really do pay with their lives in terms of homophobia. We've had situations of corrective rape, where women who've come out as lesbian have been targeted for corrective rape practices because they are taught how to be what's expected of real women. We've had, crimes against homosexual men, for example. And when you start pushing these identities and practices into secret practices, then it just complicates all sorts of other social problems. So, for example, around vectors of transmission with HIV/AIDS, if you don't allow for the expression of homosexual men in public and accept that as normal and right and avail that freedom, then all of that gets pushed under the surface. You open up spaces for unsafe sex practices, and with that you've got a different vector of infection across the spectrum. So it really is in the interest, both in terms of deepening democracy, giving substantive meaning to our constitutional rights, and just in terms of social stability, to allow for the expression of these rights and for the recognition of these multiple gendered identities in our society.
We're a little bit past our midpoint in this hour of focus. Our guest is Dr. Elaine Salo. She's director of the Institute for Women's and Gender Studies at University of Pretoria in South Africa. Before that, she was a senior lecturer at the African Gender Institute at University of Cape Town. She's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving this year's W.E.B. Du Bois lecture on the topic Lessons in Leadership for Africa, Listening to Learning from Feminist Pan-African Discussions, Activism, and Scholarship. That's this afternoon at 4 at the Levis Faculty Center on West Illinois in Urbana. She's hosted here by the Center for African Studies and the Department of African American Studies, and a long list of co-sponsors, too many to mention. I want to say that if you're interested in hearing her talk, that is free and open to the public, and anyone who's interested should feel welcome to stop by. The number also, if you want to contribute here to the conversation, the number to call, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and also email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm interested in having you talk about feminism as you think about it. This is a term where I think different people mean different things by it. So you could, I'm sure, get a lively discussion going simply by getting a group of people together and having everybody give their own definition or talk about what they think that it means. In the African context, mm-hmm. What does feminism mean?
Well, it's always seen as being that F word. It generates a lot of derision and dismissal when one claims a feminist identity in public fora. But it is of huge relevance. It takes on different forms in our context, I think, because obviously, you know, given our specific histories and geospatial contexts, feminist struggles are different. And there are similarities, for example, between the struggle for the vote here, I think, and the South African women's struggle as it overlapped with the struggle for national liberation. But then there are also specific cultural grammars of gender that help us identify sites of struggle for rights that may not otherwise be identified. For example, a colleague, a filmmaker who is British Ghanaian, Yaba Badu, she did a film on witches in Gambaga in Ghana, where a lot of women were accused of witchcraft in that northern area, and they sought refuge in a village that was created by a local imam rather than being put to death, actually. And when she did the research on this contemporary accusations of witchcraft, what she actually discovered was that in the context of a socioeconomic downturn, these otherwise successful businesswomen and prominent community leaders in their areas were often the targets of accusations of witchcraft. And one then has to ask questions about what does it mean in a context where you've got economic downturn for practices of masculinity that end up in these accusations being made. The same thing has happened in South Africa in Limpopo province as well, in terms of accusations of witchcraft, specifically targeting more vulnerable elderly women and women who are not seen as quite fitting into the community. And this is also in a context of impoverishment, in a situation where, of course, we've reached our democracy, and why aren't you displaying the economic fruits of these? And yet there's this growing inequity. So one's got to understand what the specific feminist struggles are in these contexts, with given these very specific histories and struggles as well. So for me, it is about struggles for women's rights, for social justice, and of course of sexual minorities as well. Mm. I think those are key issues for me as a feminist in the South African context. But I think there are similarities in terms of histories across the world, whether they be South, whether you're comparing struggles for education in India with struggles for education in South Africa, or whether you're comparing struggles for the vote here, as these tie up with struggles against slavery, or the second wave of feminism here, as these tie up with the civil rights movement. Hmm.
Well, I have some callers I'll get to write to. I want to promise these people. But I find myself wondering whether yet today, though, there are still people who question whether the two kind of struggles that we've talked about, sort of the national liberation struggle, which in one sense has been completed and yet is ongoing. Mm-hmm. Do people still argue about whether that and struggle for women's rights are one struggle or are two separate things?
Well, I think they're both, in the sense that the struggle for national liberation provides an opportunity for a flourishing of demands for human rights of otherwise suppressed identities. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the struggle for national liberation and who defines what that liberation is or should be, or is it, that's open and always up for contestation. And that's what makes it so exciting about being in South Africa at this current moment. Mm-hmm. Because you're seeing this as it unravels in the contemporary period, about, you know, are we defining Is this what I would call the triumphal moment of a particular national African nationalist masculinity? Who does it include? Who does it exclude? And how are we then defining an Africanity within that? Is it a narrow definition of Africanity? Is it one where there's a biological definition almost of African authenticity, or is it more of an inclusive one, taking into account all of the diverse identities within the country, including that of women and sexual minorities? Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that's difficult for, I'm sure it has been difficult for women, for gay people, for people who felt that they had even farther to go in accomplishing the goals, for them to stay up and sort of stand up and say, wait a minute, who was this, who were we doing this for? were we just doing this for some people? Or were we doing this for everybody?
You see that the composition of the anti-apartheid movements in a way already had determined that particular inclusivity. Because people who felt excluded by the narrow terms of Afrikaner nationalism and knew for whatever reason in terms of their own subjective identities that they were not included in that nationalist project sought some kind of alliance or whatever form with the broad-based anti-apartheid movement. And now, 20 years after, we're seeing these attempts through both political practice and practice in the criminal justice system and our other institutions in terms of trying to delineate who is included under our new nationalist project. Mm-hmm. And it's constantly being debated and contested. I'd like to believe that it's still an open space, but I do think that it is starting to close down. The struggle is about still keeping that space open, yeah. Forming these alliances across the whatever these divides might be, class divides, sexual orientation divides, divides of race, in order to keep the pressure on. And the Constitution remains our Bible, as it were, in terms of insisting upon those claims to realizing substantive citizenship rights.
We have some callers. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'm confused, which doesn't take much for me to get confused, but when you use the term gender rights, in my experience in the United States, including my experience at the University of Illinois and other academic institutions, as well as the military and civilian world, that some women in this country are not as equal as other women in this country in light of the history of this country, much of which is sordid when it comes to race. For example, African-American women, Latino women, Native American women, probably Asian women to some degree, I don't view gender quite in the same parameters as, say, Caucasian American women in light of the history of this country. And I can say in terms of affirmative action at some of these universities, including the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, go over there and see that the real beneficiaries, in my estimation, of affirmative action are not Latino women, Native women, Asian women to some degree, and surely not African American women. Those beneficiaries are Caucasian Americans. And when I hear you use the term gender to describe a multi-ethnic society like South Africa, I want you to be more definite and certain. What type of women are, in fact, getting these feminist gender-based rights, and what type of women are still sort of looking on standing on the outside looking in? That's my question.
Yeah, of course, you're correct in terms of identifying that there are these differentials of power and access to the benefits that a society offers along exactly race, class, location. And it's important that we recognize those differences and have these debates about what the implications of those differences are. For example, in the South African context, when you look at affirmative action, or what I'd rather like to call redress legislation, in many ways it has been in the interest, at least in the area I work in tertiary education, the immediate beneficiaries have been white women and middle-class black women. And yeah, I'm using black in that broad South African sense that includes women of Asian, mixed, and African descent, who had the qualifications and then were then able to benefit immediately from these redress legislation and policies. So one's got to think of it in terms of, at least in the context I come from, in terms of the short durée and the long durée. But it's very important to be able to have the courage to debate these issues exactly and ask exactly the questions you're asking, which is, what are the implications of these power differentials given these different histories and histories of collusion, collaboration with oppression in the interests of claiming one's race privilege despite one's gender? I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I'm just going to – that does help it, but I want to just show you how this – demarcation exists in some circles of academic African-American women and academic Caucasian or white American women. There are some academic African-American women who reject the notion of feminists primarily because they don't see themselves on the same plane as white feminists, and they call themselves womenists. And I think the fact they adopt that lets me know you got to be very careful when you paint a broad brush this quote notion of feminism and gender protected rights, because I go back to my basic theory that all women are not created and treated equally in this country, and I'm fairly certain that might be true in South Africa. But thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any further comments you'd like to make?
Well, I mean, what the caller was alluding to were all these debates within what I call the broad theoretical landscape around terminology, whether one calls oneself a womanist, and a maternal feminist, an African feminist, or just a feminist, period. I think those debates are helpful in terms of surfacing these various fractures of power in terms of our different intersectional identities. But when it comes to forming strategic alliances, I think we have to be very careful in terms of, making strategic moves to influence policy. And here again, I'm pointing back to that moment of the National Women's Coalition in South Africa, where the absence of women at the negotiation tables demanded an immediate coalition to be formed despite difference. It was only a momentary alliance, but at least it had the gain of saying, we demand as women a place at that negotiation table. And it saw to the gender mainstreaming, at least within the political sphere. So while we have the bodily representation of women at the level of political decision-making, whether those women have the consciousness to represent all of our interests given our intersectional identities becomes yet another step in terms of that process. So as one dead white male by the name of Antonio Gramsci said, it's a war of maneuver.
Let's talk with someone else. We'll go to Indiana for our toll-free line here. Hello.
Hello. Another excellent program. My question is, because I don't know when you started teaching about gender studies, but did the university there have any difficulty getting that sort of study department into the university due to basically masculine jealousy or whatever? So if that ever caused any problem. And you certainly would be, at least if it was the old days in the civil rights movement, you certainly would be under fire if you're turning out the girls that are, propagating the theories. I wonder if you have any problem with that, in terms of finding jobs or just being actually ostracized after they get a degree. Thanks.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was on faculty at the University of the Western Cape, which was the first university where women's and gender studies program was institutionalized in South Africa, and it was definitely a major struggle. But the fact that this institution's administration had aligned itself with the broad democratic movement opened up that space to be able to say, this is part of the progressive struggle. I think many of my colleagues and I who were both located within the women's movement aligned with the anti-apartheid movement, as well as faculty members at the university, provided us with the impetus to make the argument for teaching women's and gender studies courses on the campus. But it came with struggle. A lot of us, or the group of women who started out the first program, we taught it as a labor of love. There was absolutely no credits in faculty for these courses or for students. And you did it over and above the teaching that you normally did. And I promise you, it did mean quite a burden for many of us. When it was institutionalized as a program, now it is a department at the University of Western Cape, quickly other institutions followed suit, although currently it's under attack again. I suspect it's linked up with the possible restructuring of liberal arts at different universities across the campus. Right now, as we speak, the Women's and Gender Studies program at the University of KwaZulu-Natal is under threat. And certainly at the University of Pretoria, I currently sit with that current struggle as well. So it's been by no means easy to institutionalize it. It just so happens that Teresa Barnes, who's a professor of history here at U of Illinois, was one of the founding members of that program at the University of Western Cape. So there are linkages, yeah.
We're coming to the point where we have maybe about 5 or 6 minutes left. And forgive me for bringing up such a large topic at the end, but you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that it's essentially been 20 years since the end of apartheid and the election of South Africa's first black president, Mr. Mandela. And at the time, I think that people were quite optimistic about the possibility that things would change rapidly and that the lives of South Africans would be vastly improved. And while I'm certain one can say lives of South Africans have been improved, that I think that the degree of change wasn't what people had hoped, and the country certainly still has significant economic problems, and the desire to lift people up certainly is still there, and the need to lift people up. But I'm sure that there are people are disappointed that there hasn't been more progress. And I guess I wonder if you can talk about how people are feeling now.
Well, I think my sense is during the Mandela presidency, we were all caught up in that heady honeymoon moment. And it certainly was very, very exciting. We've got our feet more grounded in the reality of being part of a global community again, and also with the realities of an economic recession, both globally as well as in the South African context. And so I think expectations have been tempered. We do sit with there is some disappointment. I don't think we've realized the rights for those marginalized populations I identified earlier, women in rural areas, people living on the far margins of our urban cities. I mean, anybody who's flown into Cape Town or Johannesburg can attest to the diversity of housing that you see that are markers of both first world and third world, if you will, living conditions. And right now, I think socioeconomic rights are very important rights, specifically for poor women in terms of access to service delivery. We need to be challenging the limitations of the suite of equity legislation so that it isn't as it is now being threatened by concentration in the hands of a few in the elite, as well as the rise of an African nationalist masculinity that is trying to define Africanity in terms of a very narrow but false notion of authenticity.
Mm-hmm. And for the way people think about leadership, I wonder too how people think about those men who came after Nelson Mandela. And I suppose anybody who came after Nelson Mandela was going to be in a very difficult position. But certainly there was a lot of criticism of Thabo Mbeki and how he did. And then now we have this even more controversial figure in the person of Mr. Zuma. Now, there was enough, I think there was enough unhappiness with Thabo Mbeki that it essentially split the leadership of the African National Congress. And we had some guys who were saying they were going to go off and start their own party, which I don't really think went much of anywhere. And then with Mr. Zuma, as I said, we have someone who is even more controversial and problematic in his background, and leaves me wondering what people think about where things have gone now that you have the second after Mr. Mandela and the third in the post-apartheid era black presidents.
I think the debate about the meanings of leadership, what values leaders should embody in their person, in terms of their practice, that's a big debate currently raging at home at the moment. And it's a good one. And it cannot be now targeted specifically in terms of race, because there have been all sorts of claims around racism when these very important debates have been raised. What you're finding is key thinkers, journalists, people who write op-ed pieces in the newspapers of all colors taking on these issues. I think what you're seeing reflected within the ANC was a rejection of Thabo Mbeki, yes, also because of his very bad handling of the HIV/AIDS issue, but also it's the split in terms of class alliances within the ANC. Hmm. But I hesitate when I say that, because actually what you have is a very informed trade union movement and a communist party, which is led by strategic and very well-educated thinkers. And then you've got a populist grouping now represented by the ANC Youth League leadership, and that I find a little scary. And we need to take on the challenge presented to them in terms of what do you mean by leadership? What are the values and practices? Yes, you're right. I mean, Zuma, at least from where I sit, does not embody leadership, not in my book. But we have to ask whether he was just placed there in a holding position while these debates about leadership continue within the ANC. It's not necessarily a bad thing that we've had the Congress of the People split off from the ANC, because just recently Moluleke George, who is one of the key people in COPE, which is the breakaway section of the ANC who formed the new political party of Mbeki, raised exactly this issue within Parliament, and this started up quite a debate.
We're going to have to stop. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, we'd like to hear more from our guest, Dr. Elaine Salo. She'll be giving the annual W.E.B. Du Bois lecture on the campus this afternoon at 4. Lessons in Leadership for Africa, Listening to, Learning from Feminine Pan-African Discussion, Activism, and Scholarship. So that's this afternoon, 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the campus. Also, by the way, if people in the community will have another opportunity to hear from her, she'll be talking about Lessons in Leadership from Feminist African Women at the Urbana Free Library this weekend, Saturday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon in the Lewis Auditorium. So there, again, people can stop by and hear her. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Programs here on WILL made possible in part by the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Klezmer King David Krakauer and funk legend Fred Wesley in Abraham Incorporated on March 2nd. More information on this and other events can be found at krannertcenter.com. WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio adjacent to Campbell Hall for public telecommunication. That's it for us on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be Jennifer Thorne Amon. She's with the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy and one of the authors of the Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings. Home Energy Savings, our topic this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. In Kansas City, March wheat is trading at 501.5, down 7. May, 512.25, down 7.25. Chicago, March wheat, 495.75, down 5.5. May, 509.25, down 6. March corn, 368.75, down 2.75. May, 379.75, down 3. July, 390, down 3.75. September, 397.25, down 4. March beans, 968.5, up 7. May, 974.75, up 5.75. July, 981, up 5.75. August, 973.25, up 2.75. Quarters September, 952.5, up 1/2.